It's an honor to have the first talk in this series, especially without guidelines. That's good. But that put me also in the position that I was not exactly sure what you were expecting. So let's see. So you can criticize afterwards or during the talk also. Okay, so what I gave as a title was Arto-Second Laser-Driven Electron Dynamics in Molecules. And that will be actually the main part of the talk. I will talk about something that is a sub-cycle laser-induced electron dynamics in H2+, and then discuss a bit what this might have an impact on ionization, and very recently we looked also at high harmonic generation. And then just yesterday, following our discussion, I was thought that I have to put a teaser at least into this, because Tony is very interested in long wavelengths, and Andrew mentioned that he hopes that I talk about zeptosecond waveforms or pulses. I don't have much about this, but maybe it's a teaser for what our postdoc Carlos will then maybe present next week or so. So let's see how far we come. Contributions by this is from our group. Now involved is mainly Michel Miller in this program. Then for the zeptosecond waveforms, Carlos, so in the group that I'm heading. Part of the story, or main part of the story, goes a bit back also. So this is involved for Fenghe and Norio Takemoto. Fenghe is who is now at Shanghai, in Shanghai at the University of Norio, who is in a kind of transition from the Study Institute in Korea now to Dresden. And then I will show some experiment by Rana Dörner and Uwe Kuhn was also involved. Because Fenghe was also postdoc of Uwe Kuhn. Okay, so we talk about Arto-second dynamics, but what we know most in our field is, and I start pretty simple as first speaker, with a tunnel ionization picture that we certainly all know. So here's the Coulomb potential of the atom. That is the electric field of the laser field, and we know we have the superposition of the two, and this is our actual potential, and then we form here a tunnel barrier. And the picture is then that the electron can find out here as a quasi-static picture, very successful in our field. If we want to look at this a bit more time-dependent, and this is what I want to go into is, then since we have a laser pulse, we would say that the ionization is, would expect that the ionization is certainly strongest at the peak of the pulse where the electric field is strongest, so the barrier here is smallest, so we expect that the final ionization probability is strongest. And if we look at this a bit more time dependently, which is one of the citations that have looked at this, is if you look at the cycle of an oscillating field, you expect that the ionization actually is strongest always when the field is at the max. That is quite obvious because the tunnel barrier is the lowest. Now that is true for an atom, and now comes a bit delicate picture thing, because one of our organizers is now the expert in what I'm talking about, has introduced this. This is the so-called Cray picture, where we have enhanced ionization for a molecule, let's say H2+, at intermediate internuclear distances. I think this is even from your first publication of this one. So where it was predicted that the ionization rate of such a molecule, of the electron out of such a molecule is strongest at some internuclear distances, so somewhere over here, where there is a strong coupling between these two different electronic levels, so the ground level, the sigma G level, and the sigma U level. And this is the kind of quasi-static picture that one has then. So if one has a superposition of these two, the coupling, if one has a strong coupling of these two levels in the field, one forms two new states. The plus state and the minus state was called by Andre, and then one sees that the electron can escape here at some internuclear distances very easily above actually this time.
I mean, in this figure on the left,
on the left,
where is 8? That would be in the tail.
That is somewhere over here, I think.
Yes, yeah. So that's where the strong coupling.
Yeah, so the strong coupling. So this is something in H2+, I think, is 2 atomic units. So we are somewhere over here, but this is not to scale, it's actually just a sketch. But we are somewhere over here, so you can find this out if you are dissociating.
The deterrence field remains for even longer distances, or do they move apart again?
They are moving apart even further, and what is happening then is this barrier becomes larger and larger, and then you see here already that you are forming a tunnel again, and that's why the ionization rate is dropping. So you have really ionization rates at the highest.
It drops down to the atomic values.
Yes. Yeah. So then you are forming, you have one H atom.
Yeah.
So you should expect that you're dropping down to the...
So the deterrence remains with those two curves, right?
Yes.
Between one and the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And the atomic value is what fraction of the molecular value?
Yeah.
So it, I mean, it's a factor of two.
Hold on to the hydrogen atom ionization rate.
But it's a factor of two or three?
Oh, it's about 10.
10?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay, so we made then... what we did more recently, which is also already 3 or 4 years ago, is we looked at time-dependent simulations of this process. So we are solving the time-dependent Schrodinger equation for this one. And what we found out was, here's the picture for the hydrogen atom. So this is the electric field, a rather long field here actually, 27 femtoseconds. And we are looking into the central field circuit. So here you see the electric field. Going up. And you find that the ionization rate or the ionization probability is strongest always at the maxima of the field, as you would expect from the time of ionization. Now what we have found there for H2 plus was that for certain intensities and wavelengths, and in this region of about 7 to 10 atomic units internuclear distance, that the ionization probability as a function of time over one cycle looks quite different from this one that we see here. And we have chosen then a picture, so you can find several different kinds of forms here, but here is, for example, a picture where actually the ionization probability near the peak of the maximum of the field is actually zero. And you find that the ionization probabilities are more at maximum at two different instances, either before or after the maximum. So it's quite different to that what we would expect from the time line.
So it's not a rate by probability or
graph? It's a rate actually what we have done here. We have calculated as a flux through a boundary and then turned it into a rate.
But there should be some delay once it reaches the boundary, or?
First of all, this we have not taken a boundary, but we have taken a flux through something which was relatively close to the limit area.
Okay.
Yeah. So
there's no pivot motion. If you make it very close, then you are
I'm coming to this now because you see, for example, this peak here. This is something where the electron goes in and out. So we have calculated actually the flux that goes out. Yeah. So certainly you have to be looking. Okay, so we see we saw this kind of picture here, which somehow didn't agree to the quasi-static picture that I was introducing before, where we would expect that the ionization probability is largest actually at the maxima of the field. So we look a bit closer into this, and what you see here now is this is the electron position. So I always forget this. I should mention that H2 plus molecule, you have to orient somehow with respect to the laser polarization. So this linear polarization, let's say linear polarization in this direction, and the molecule is aligned along the laser polarization. Yeah, and this is the laser polarization direction. It's the probability where you find the electron is shown here. So this is the position of one nucleus, this is the position of the other nucleus, and then you see here really that how the flux is coming out or how the probability is going out. So this would be one of these, what we also call one of these ionization bursts, and that one would be the next one, and then here you see another small half. So this is the first half cycle of the field again, and that's the second half cycle of the field. So just in agreement with this one.
It's a one-dimensional calculation, right?
I'm coming to this now.
Sorry.
So this is calculated with moving nuclei. So the nuclear dynamics is taken into account, and two-dimensional electron dynamics. Along the laser polarization perpendicular to this. Yeah? So this is how we would call it, a 2+1D calculation.
So the nuclei just classically coupled to the
no. Quantum
mechanics.
Or quantum. So you're solving the
three-particle Schrodinger equation.
Sorry?
So it's a three-particle Schrodinger equation.
Yes.
Good.
With one dimension in the nuclear motion. So we have not taken into account rotation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so only vibration along the polarization mm-hmm. or along the thing. And then 2D in electron.
So you have completely different grids and for the protons as you have for the electron.
No, I don't need that.
No, he just R, rho, Z, that's all. Or R and X, Y.
So why is this pretense? Because it's so different masses, you probably have different wavelengths and...
But, okay, you can do this for a while.
If you go back one second,
sure.
The figure here, these minima around the plus minus 0.25, are they due to interference, or are these really two different bursts?
These are two different bursts, yeah? You see, here's one burst, and then there's nothing, and there's the next burst.
So
here's the field at maximum.
Right, but I mean, could it be that the amplitudes for each burst interfere right there?
Yeah, so this I want to do now. That's why I need to really analyze. So we are trying to figure out why this happens. Okay, so first we see this picture, and that is a 2+1D calculation. So our first question was, or we tried to simplify this, the whole process now. So we said that instead of a 2+1D calculation, we take the electron dynamics only along the polarization direction. So we drop completely the transversal part. And we got essentially the same picture. I don't have it here, but that doesn't matter. Then the next one was, maybe there's a strong coupling between electron and nuclear dynamics. Yeah. Maybe that is the reason of this one. This you can also test by taking out this result and make a second calculation where you're freezing the nuclei. So we are freezing the nuclei at 7 atomic units, and then the same calculation again. So 1D in electron dynamics now, and frozen nuclei, much simpler than before. And what you get is this kind of picture. And it still looks essentially the same like this one. Yeah, so there is, again, yeah, small differences here, but essentially you have a burst here, you have a burst here. So this is all fine. Yeah? So there is the reason for this whole thing is not a coupling between electron and nuclear dynamics, it's just the electron dynamics that plays a role. Now then, we look at this quiver motion and rescattering effect. So we were putting absorbing boundaries closer and closer to the nuclei, and found also that rescattering effects play no role, but that this, what we see here, is actually electron dynamics of a rescattering electrons that comes from this side and goes out again. So that is not a real burst. So the real bursts, two ionization bursts, are these two, which are happening just before the field maximum and just after the field maximum. So if you want to follow again, here's the electric field again, and that is the electric potential. So the whole thing has nothing to do with rescattering, so that's why we believe at that time it has not much to do with interferences, actually. And it's not electron-nuclear dynamics, so it's just the electron dynamics. So we felt that it has to do with the electron dynamics inside the molecule. And so I think this was plotted on a logarithmic one, and this one is not plotted on a linear one, where you again see where is the electron located, and you see that the electron during one half cycle of the field is actually located twice as a maximum near this nuclei, and then on this side, exactly where we have these bursts. Yeah? And actually you, and this for people like I can go on, work quite a lot on H2+, might be not very surprised, you can actually recapture that this population or where is the electron located just with this two-state one. You can drop all the other states and you can just keep the sigma u and the sigma g, which you can transform into position also in left and right. So where is the electron located? and then you see, you get exactly the same thing back before. Yeah, so you can essentially analyze the whole dynamics that we are seeing here, what the electron is doing inside the molecule, and which is leading them to disperse, because the electron is the leaving one, it's on the side, just also just with a two-step, which is
a simple step.
L and R is left and right. So I'm saying here's laser polarization left proton and right proton. Yeah, so if you want this one is right and this one is left. Yeah. Okay, so this is how far we could break it down at this point. Say it has nothing to do with the dimensions of the electron dynamics, there's no electron nuclear couplings. Rescattering effects don't play a role, so interferences obviously don't play a role. It's the dynamics of the electrons inside the molecule. How is it driven by the laser field inside the molecule, which plays actually the role. Okay, so we try to understand this, and actually understood this before already, if you look at the years of the publications, from a different study. Let me try to explain this. So what we did here is we plotted a beta distribution so that we are getting the position here now of the electron along the polarization direction and its momentum along the polarization direction. Besides this, you see the kind of the same picture again. Yeah, you see the electron position in this direction where you have the nuclei here and here. And now you're seeing everything that is red is a maximum, everything that is blue is a minimum. Yeah? It shows you how the electron flux is going inside the molecule, or the electron probability is flowing inside the molecule. Now, for this calculation, we have put the electron in the sigma u state, and due to an interference effect between the nuclei, there's the interference now, you will get then that the momentum of the electron is modulated by a sine square of p times r. P is the momentum of the electron. R is the internuclear distance divided by half. So, and this is actually also what you see. Here's the sine square, these are the maxima, and these are some central minimum here.
And there's a free electron. What would be the amplitude of a free electron in such a field?
Out of my head, I cannot calculate it. So, for this kind of intensity, also?
Yeah, that frequency, yeah.
Something like 2 atomic units or so.
So it's comparable.
Yes.
It's comparable. The size of the molecule.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is actually the formula that you get without the field. Now we know that in the field, this whole thing, the momentum of the electron has to be replaced by this formula with the help of the vector potential. And the vector potential is now time dependent. So the momentum will change with the time dependent change of the vector potential. Now as long as the field strength is small, this factor does not play much of a role. So what is happening now is if the field is driving the electron, it's driving the electron at low intensities just from one side. So first it's located here, then a bit later in time it's located over here. So it's driving it to the other nucleus and it arrives at the other nucleus. So this is more or less one half cycle of the field. Electron first located here, driving through this, what we also call a momentum gate, over to the other side. But you see already, even for this weak field, what is happening, there's an influence of this vector potential. These kind of momenta are shifted while the electron is driving to the other side. Now, if A becomes stronger and stronger, which means that the intensity of the field becomes stronger and stronger, at some point, this factor, or this term, becomes at its maximum, which means that the zero of the field is larger than this P, this first P here, that we get from our sine square. Yeah, and so what is happening is that while the electron is driven from one side to the other side, its momentum is changing, and actually, it can change so much so that the sign of the momentum is turning. What does it mean? Well, the electron starts on one side, it starts to be driven to the other nucleus, vector potential becomes larger, and at some point, its side is changing, which means that the electron is driven back during the half-field cycle to the other nucleus, to the same nucleus. So while here by low intensities, electron is always driven like this from one side to the other side. What is happening here is electron starts on this side, but its momentum is changing due to the vector potential, and it ends up at the same nucleus again. So here it's ending up after one half cycle at the same nucleus again. Here it's ending up, at the other nucleus. Here it's ending up at the same nucleus. Now, if intensity becomes even larger, then this whole thing is happening now several times. So electron actually can go either, end up either on this side or on the same side.
Okay, Andreas, I'm trying to interpret these figures. The, the bands at the top and the bottom are the probabilities at each nuclear site.
These ones,
yes. And these.
So in the red is always the maximum.
But these big red blobs, about minus one, but what does that denote?
That denotes that you can find the electron also here in between. So that the probability of the electron, to find the electron, is driven from one side to the other side.
So
and it's going with these different momentum, with these different momentum. So and at these low intensities, electron is just driven from one side to the other. What is happening here is, now at some point, the intensity or the vector potential becomes so large, electron starts on one side and returns to the same thing. Yeah? So it's not our adiabatic picture that the electron follows all the time the field, but inside the molecule, electron can also do a completely different dynamics. And then if you go to even higher intensities, so electron can either swap over to the other side or come back. Yeah, so you become much more kind of chaotic.
You're plotting the canonical momentum or the velocity there?
The canonical momentum. So that gives us a kind of idea what is happening here. So an electron is starting to swap over to the side and gets ionized, but part of the probability of the distribution of the electron is also turning back to this nucleus again.
Sorry for being slow.
No.
If you can, it's not going back, I'm still not getting it. So the field triggers somehow that the electron, which that stays on the left side, is now moving to the right.
Right.
But for some reason, at this magic 2 to the 10 to the 13, some of the field manages to reverse the velocity to bring the guy back to where it started, even though the whole cycle hasn't, even the field hasn't even reversed.
Yes, it goes actually against the field.
Why is it triggering it then from the beginning to go, let's say, to the right? If a millisecond later it reverses it already before the whole thing.
Because the vector potential is changing in time.
But that's the very mechanism that it starts going to the right. It's the vector potential.
Yes. So at the beginning,
during this time scale, the vector potential shows in the same direction. So it has two roles, right? One's triggering the electrons start going to the right. But then with the same sign of it, it reverses it after it's
yes,
like a water cycle. Or
because it becomes larger and larger, it's now reversing the whole thing.
So the middle feels like a barrier all of a sudden in the middle of the cycle. So it starts to roll down, and then it sees this hill, and then comes back without reaching
the I would not go with a field picture. With the static field picture, it goes against the hill, actually. If you stay with this one. But it's not like that it's first rolling down. It's first rolling down and then it's rolling up there. Yeah. If you were with this classical picture.
But I mean, you start with a superposition table wave packet which has this localized moving from left to right. Yes.
Right.
So you have started with a superposition state in some way. Because otherwise you wouldn't have any movement of the wave packet.
Yes, I'm here in the middle of the cycle already. So
this was my question. What are the moments of the cycle, which are these four plots, rows correspond to?
This responds again to the central part of your path. So there you're in the superposition of your two states already. So you have covered these two states.
So it's very close around the maximum.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because it's somehow missing, unfortunately. This wasn't clear.
Yeah, so if you do this at the beginning, you start to couple first and everything goes just around.
So in your also have this negative 2, negative 1, 0, 1 on your picture.
Yeah, so, okay, so I forgot to tell the numbers. So you have here maxima and minima from the side square, yeah? And we are just naming this. So this is at 0 p, this is at where this one becomes pi half or pi. And so you're getting one momentum gate after the other, yeah? And here you see that here we are shifting this momentum gate actually to the middle and then over to the other side so that the electron can swap back. And here this field strength is so strong that actually we are shifting through several of these momentum gates, which just shows you if we would show you now more plots here, that the electron is going back and forth all the time. And partially it's swapping over and partially it's going back. So we have not this kind of adiabatic dynamics inside the molecule that we would expect.
Okay, but the z-axis is between those two red atoms there.
This one?
No, on the left, the figure on the left.
Yeah. This one?
The z-axis is through the nuclei. No.
No, yeah, this is right here.
Yeah, yeah. And this sine squared rho r,
this is a kind of sketch how I want to show you that there are momentum gates.
Uh-huh.
This is simulating these two maxima. And these two momentum gates are shifting back and forth like this.
I see.
It's just a sketch.
Right.
Yeah.
Because maybe it's in the other directions.
No, the z direction is this way. And these are these momentum gates which are now shifting like this.
Okay.
So
it's
a pz axis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So this is our explanation that there is a kind of, how you want to call it, non-adiabatic dynamics in this, which actually are leading then to this kind of isolation.
Oh, one quick question, because it's about Wigner distribution. The whole thing is also negatively indicating truly quantum mechanical information, or how is the sign of the Wigner function?
This is actually, here it's negative. Here it's negative.
So that means that's a purely quantum domain.
Yes.
It can never be.
Yeah. It can never enter this part.
Classically,
yeah. Okay, so then we did also an analysis, and that's would be a longer thing, with a two-state model. And from this one we can come up with a condition whether the electron is localized on the left state or in the right state. On the left nucleus or on the right nucleus. And these conditions for that the electron is localized, let's say, on this side, looks like this. So let me walk you through this. So this is, again, the time-dependent vector potential. Again, maximum of the vector potential, and this is the time dependence. And this is the condition for the localization at which times the electron is localized, let's say, on one side. And then M is just a number, pi is pi, and this is the dipole transition matrix element between the G state and the U state. Yeah, so it turns out as simple as this. Now, this gives us a condition at times, whenever this equation is fulfilled, you have a time when the electron is localized at either one of the two protons. Now, certainly you see that I can fulfill this condition always. If I set m equal to 0, at some point the sine is equal to 0, so that gives me a time of localization. Yeah, at one of the nucleus. And that is clear, because whenever the vector potential is at 0, the field is at maximum, and that is just our adiabatic picture. The electron would follow the field, goes to one side, goes to the other side, and is there always at the maximum. Now we find, however, that we can fulfill this condition also at different times, namely, if this one becomes large, because then the whole thing becomes small. So then this whole thing becomes small, and I can fulfill this also for maybe m equal to plus minus 1 or plus minus 2. And that gives me other times during my half cycle. Yeah, so if a naught, my vector potential is larger than this part here, which means that this one should become large, which is true at intermediate distances. I can confirm this also for m not equal to 0, which means at other times than the maximum. Yeah. And you have calculated for this part that I've shown you before. This remember our results from our numerical simulations. And now you see here again the field cycle. And these lines show you now the predictions that come out of this condition. And you see this agrees quite exactly with that the electrons either localize on this side or on this side. So this gives you a kind of condition for this one. And from this one, you can expect that you can have these localizations either once per field cycle, or twice, or three times, or etc. So that was the kind of, I think, my analysis, theoretical part of the analysis for these kind of non-adiabatic or strange electron dynamics. Now the question is, can one ever observe something like this? And we feel that this was observed, or that we could observe this in a collaboration with Rana-Gerner. Now not with linear polarization, but with circular polarization. And for this, I need to introduce a concept that is the so-called Artuk clock that was first used, as far as I know, by Ursula Penner and Rainer Turner. And the idea is the following. So I start again with an atom first, nucleus, and an electron. So with circular polarization, if this is my electric field vector, for circular polarization, this field vector is starting to turn around. And I'm thinking now, how does the ionization in such a circularly polarized field looks like for an atom? So first of all, this field vector is turning around once every cycle of your field, which is for 800 nanometer, 2.6 femtoseconds. So you have this as your hand of your clock, and it, so the electric field vector is the hand of your clock, and that's why it's called so-called an atom. Yeah, and what you expect for the atomic case, but it's if it's a simple 1s hydrogen atom, for example, then it doesn't matter in which direction the electric field vector looks like. So the ionization probability of is the same independent of which direction the electric field vector looks like. And the momentum distribution that you expect should be just this kind of donor. Yeah, so that's the expectation. Actually, this has been also observed. Yeah? So, but if I do the same thing for a molecule, then we know that, for example, for an H2 plus molecule, the electron is more easily ionized when the electric field vector is pointing along the internuclear axis than if it's perpendicular to it. Now, momentum follows not the electric field vector, but the vector potential. So I'm expecting that within my donut, I see maxima here and here, exactly when it's so when the electric field vector is pointing in this direction, vector potential is there, or the other way, and then I'm expecting that I see maxima here and here. So this is what is expected. Now what you see in our numerical simulations is actually that we see some maxima here, but the main maxima is actually somehow tilted, yeah? So we don't see the maxima here and here, but we see it at some tilted angle, yeah? Which tells us now, going back to this Artuk clock idea, that the electron should be ionized not when the electric field vector is pointing in this direction, but has rotated a bit further. So it's also similar like what we had seen before for linear polarization, where we have seen that ionization bursts were not at the maximum of the field, but also here, this gives us an indication that the electron has somehow left the molecule at times a bit later than when the field vector has pointed in the cell. So quite similar to linear
polarization. So this is for IQ7s. So how about the IQ2 at the equilibrium?
Oh, for IQ2,
yeah,
you find this whole thing here. So this whole, I should have pointed this out before also. So if you do the whole calculation that I showed you before for IQ2, you find just the boring normal picture. Yeah, so there is nothing. Yeah, because there is no strong coupling between the two states.
Yes.
You need the strong coupling between the two states, as you could see from our localization. Yeah? Okay. And this was actually, to our pleasant surprise, in very nice agreement with an experiment that Reinhard Dörner has done. So here's a momentum distribution in two different directions in the similar way that we have done it in theory. And you see also that he does not find the maxima here and here, but he finds it at this tilde there.
Cool. Two questions. First, how did the experiment put the molecule in a separation cell?
Oh, they start to dissociate it. And then, you know, Reinhard, you know maybe the experiments from Reinhard Dörner, he's doing cold rich experiments. So if you ionize the H2 plus molecule, its Kulov explodes. He's measuring the electron and one of the protons, and he's measuring the kinetic energy release from the proton. And from the kinetic energy release, he can calculate back at which internuclear distance the ionization has happened.
You hit it with the circular polarized pulse while it's dissociated.
You are initiating the whole dissociation process with the circular polarized pulse, and then the ionization is happening at different distances in his experiment. But he can track it back since he is measuring the kinetic energy.
So when the ionization occurs at 7, then it agrees with the theoretical prediction.
Right, and you will see in the next picture that he has actually done it at different internuclear distances. So he can in one experiment he gets ionization at all different internuclear distances, but he can map it out or can calculate it back since he has the energy of the proton.
So you can choose any particular R=2.
Yes, yes, all of
any.
Them.
This is only for R=7. Yes.
Yes.
It's judged by the
kinetic distance of the ionization is maximum parallel to the ventricular axis.
Parallel to the axis.
When the electric field E is parallel to the ventricular axis, that's when the ionization is maximum. That's why it works.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he has also not aligned this molecule before. But since he is measuring where the protons are going, he can also find out how the molecule was oriented at the moment of ionization.
Okay.
So he's been tracking this now.
The other thing is Lars Metzler published a fast track communication about ionization of atoms with circular polarized light, and the title of the paper was "Strange Shift of the Distribution," and we showed analytically that the shift is due to a dynamical phase. I mean, it's really the ionization amplitude has a phase, and that phase is measured in the experiment.
So yeah.
So the question here is there such a dynamical phase causing the shift?
There is also a dynamical phase, but this dynamical phase is much smaller than the tilt that we see. So this tilt is much larger than what you see in the atomic. Okay, so this is more or less an agreement, I think, as I promised. The experimental data and also the theoretical data we have for in different internuclear distances. And what is measured now is this tilt angle as compared to the this axis here, experimentally as well as theoretically, so by how much this is tilted. And you see this depends on internuclear distance. And, there's also not complete agreement between experiment and theory. There's qualitative agreement. And also, what we get is, you can get the radial momentum here. So this is the momentum at which you would expect for circular polarization for an atom, the maximum of your distribution. And this is what you get from experiment, and this is what you get from theory. So there is qualitative agreement, but not full quantitative agreement. So we obviously see the effect there, but we have not quantitatively fully reproduced the experimental data.
Yes?
Yeah.
Can you go back to the 2D momentum pictures?
This one?
Yeah. You know, I'm just wondering, if you have circularly polarized fields, and you have many cycle pulses like in the experiment, I'm just surprised that the emission is so well localized considering that the field amplitude doesn't change a lot over a large range of angles.
Yeah,
You know what that means?
That we have not looked in. You see, we there is a big difference between what we can calculate and or what we could calculate at that moment and what
I'm has been done. What do you mean? What do you mean?
So
that the amplitude
is few seconds.
So
if one one cycle.
So you would expect that this is much broader and much wider also.
It's more a donut, yeah. Because let's say one cycle is 2.6 femtoseconds, which means 360 degrees. Now let's say on the left you have. What is this, 15 cycles or something, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
So in a circular polarized field, the field amplitude goes up, right? And then slowly down again. So there is not a rapid change. Exactly, there's not a rapid change of field amplitude. And if you have a multi-cycle pulse like this, or let's say two cycles or something, there is basically nearly no difference in field amplitude and therefore peak intensity. So I would expect that this smears out a lot if it's not some kind of interference.
So you're saying if there are many cycles, many of these spirals have comparable magnitude?
Yep.
Well, many is here a question. So if this is a something like maybe a 12-cycle pulse or something like this, I would expect that there's ionization of about 3, maybe 4
this
cycles.
This is Coulombs half maximum. So
it's sure,
24.
But this is
cycles.
Maybe.
Yeah.
10 degrees.
But certainly here it's just one cycle. So that is a clear difference between experiment and theory, and we could not resolve.
Okay,
and that, as I show you, here's also a big difference. Well, I would not say that there's a quantitative agreement. It's a qualitative agreement. But you see the trend is at least, it's okay. Okay, so and then what you can do now in theory, if you have solved this, the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, you can go try to figure out whether get a snapshot of the probability density at the moment of ionization. Yeah. So this is here are the two new different nuclei here, sitting here and here, and what you see here is that the electron is escaping in this direction, or there is a probability distribution going out in this direction, which is actually leading. One of these two different maxima. But you see also what has happened is that the probability distribution was swapping over to this side. It is on its way back already, but part of this has returned again to this nucleus. So what we would expect in principle is that this electron probability density is always going around like this. But you see here's part of this is really going back, but then another part was coming back and it's getting ionized. So it's a kind of similar picture like we have for so that is there's something like 350, or if you have a precise postdoc, it's 356 attoseconds after the field was aligned along the internuclear distance when the electron gets ionized. Now, and yesterday Alejandro said something about molecular movies, and that remembered me of a story that we had with this kind of discovery. So we were talking also about that what we are doing is a molecular movie, and somehow a journalist became interested in this. And so she made then a title about this, said that the Atomclub turns the electrons into movie stars. But she pushed me very much, so she wanted to publish this picture here actually. She pushed me very much on telling her what this picture means. And somehow I had the feeling she captured what I said, that we are making a molecular movie and we should be careful with this. So she captured movie, electron is escaping by a tunnel. And the caption of this figure was that this is the Steve McQueen of the tunnel. So you can think about which movie she is thinking about, the Steve McQueen with an escape by a tunnel. So if you don't know it, you can look it up.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is what came out of this.
So what's your overall? My impression is, in the time I attempted to publish some of our work for a general audience, is that these journalists have their own ideas of what they want to write about, and they keep pushing you in the wrong direction. They don't want to know what you say.
Okay, I don't know why I want to make a strong comment on this, but at some point you don't have influence anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. So they sent you something and there's no way that you can change it anymore. Yeah, so, but this is her, what she said. Now, she has not quoted me on that, so this is not my quote. But anyway, maybe it's nice just that people are talking about what they are doing. But I was thinking about this as Aishanu yesterday said that we should be careful with that we are making a monitor. So this is how it might end. Okay.
So what is that gray line over there?
This was, I think, just the electric field or the potential. So I would have to look it up. Sorry. So very recently we did some calculations. Here I show you one, how the calculation actually looks like at I equal 2 or so. So this is the probability density of the electron at I equal 2. You see really this is just the normal dynamics that you have, that the electron is swapping from one side to the other. At the same time at I equal 7, you have these different kind of localizations, again over just one field cycle of the pulse. And what Michelle Miller did then in our group was she was calculating high harmonic generation from this. And this is the spectrum that you see at I equal 2, just the normal spectrum with this cutoff. So we have arranged that the cutoff is more or less at the same position. And for I equal 7, she saw that the this kind of spectrum with a quite pronounced dip here in this one. And with help of the time frequency analysis, et cetera, she could really trace back that this minimum corresponds to that at the field maximum here, the electron is not ionized. Yeah? So that this minimum in ionization probability leads to this, that the electron also cannot return at certain times, and that did lead really to this pronounced dip here. So maybe at some point in high harmonic generation, this with the help of minima, I know we had several kind of minimas already in high harmonic generation, but maybe with such a kind of signal, one can also see this kind of intermolecular dynamics. So I don't know how long I talked already, but Andre asked yesterday I should talk about such a second part. So I finished in principle the first part of the story. I don't know if it's invalid. The rest is in principle just a teaser because I don't have
a. I think it'd be interesting to see. Can you make guys up to second pulses in harmonic generation? Can you say a few words about that?
I would say continue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had good discussion, and
sure.
Don't worry about the time.
Okay. So I have just a few slides. So because I didn't prepare much for this because our postdoc Carlos Hernandez is coming in next week, and he is the expert in all the calculations. But you might know that Margaret Mundane and Henry Kaptain have succeeded in making a KV X-ray generation by a high harmonic generation, so a tabletop towards a tabletop X-ray laser. So this is the experimental spectrum that they got at 3.9 or 4 micrometer at this intensity with helium, and this is the kind of spectrum that they have measured, which goes up to above 1 keV here. And we did a calculation for this one, which looks from its shape actually pretty similar. So this is so far not zeptoseconds, but I will tell you now that the zeptoseconds actually is this shaded line part here of the spectrum. Now, this is the harmonic spectrum. If the chirp would be just constant over all the harmonics and you would make just a Fourier transform limited pulse, you would expect that you can get a 2.5 microsecond pulse out of this. Now, experimentally, you see that the chirp or that the phase is changing. So what you really get out is a pulse that is 1.2 femtoseconds long. But the chirp is rather smooth and might be able to compensate this at some point. So that one can really go into the regime of 2 arcoseconds. But actually we found then later out that within these pulses, there is actually a much faster time scale, and that goes towards the second pulses now. So let me explain you this a bit. So here I show you how the harmonics are generated, how the different femtosecond pulses are generated during the interaction. So you have here the first harmonic burst, here the second harmonic burst, third harmonic burst, etc., etc. This is the harmonic spectrum, how it looks like, and the total harmonic spectrum. And then we have looked at the harmonic spectrum for each of these harmonic bursts that you see here. And what is happening in this pulse is now that you have multiple, so-called multiple rescatterings. So coming back, this is an atom node. There's tether ionization happening. So ionization of the electron is always happening at the maximum of the field. Harmonic generation, electron gets ionized, it's driven back and recombines. So to have recombination at this point, we can have electron being ionized here, and it's coming back, gets recombined here. Or you can have a so-called second order heavy scattering where electron is ionized here. It's first driven to one side, comes back, misses, or does is not recombined, goes over to the other side and returns here and recombines here. So that is first order rescattering, second order rescattering, and actually we can have even third order rescattering where electron gets ionized here, goes first to this side, comes back, misses the atom, goes to this side, comes back again, misses the atom, comes back a third time and gets recombined here. So these are three different events, and each of these events gives us a harmonic signal here. So you see here, this is the signal from the first order rescattering, from the third, and this from the second order rescattering in your in the photoenergy. And you can also see this in the harmonic spectrum here. And there should be now interferences between these different rescatterings. And actually, this is what we see here. Oops. Yeah, which we see really in this one. So we are looking now in more detail into the emission of this peak here, which in time looks like a 2.6 femtosecond pulse. But this pulse is actually modulated here, as you see here. So the electric field comes actually in bursts within this one. And there is, within this 2.6 femtoseconds also, there is something like 500 or 1,000 bursts. And that's why we call this one a waveform, and this waveform is on much shorter time scales now. In this case, what we have calculated here is something like 500 seconds. And then you can go further. So this was done, I think, at 2 micron or 3 micron. And then you can go further and speculate a bit if in experiment it ever becomes possible to, let's say, go to something like 8 or 10 microns. These waveforms or these bursts within this kind of peaks become so short that you go below 1 microsecond.
So you're saying this is a theoretical prediction, not an experiment?
No, this is theoretical. Oh, it might be there an experiment actually already, but it has never been measured.
I don't wonder it could go to 10 nanometers.
No, no, this you cannot. But
micrometers.
So this was done at the wavelength that they have measured the experimental spectrum.
Which is about 4 microns, right?
So the theoretical, yeah. Something like 3 or 4 microns. So the theoretical prediction is that she has something like this already, but she doesn't know how to measure it. But there's, well, we have an experimentalist here, so you might speculate how it could measure something. But, so this harmonic emission at this point should actually come in these kind of bursts or waves. And then, yeah, that's a speculation. This is just a theoretical prediction now. If you scale, this would scale further to longer driving wavelengths, and you would come to surface.
And the question is how you would filter these out so you could look at processes initiated by a zeptosecond pulse.
How I get out of these 1,000, just two of them, yeah. On this, video, I think you still have to work with it.
This is a frontier.
Yeah. Another task for Jens.
What?
Yeah. Another task for Jens.
Wait for me.
Okay, I think that's all. So that's
good. Thank you.
Good start.
So any further questions?
Yeah, that's a small question about how you extract the instantaneous dilation rates. You show the figure from molecule and the atom, right? Because you have to you show the burst contraction rate of the molecule, but you have to extract what's called a instantaneous action rate, aggregation rate, right?
Yeah, so.
How you actually do that, and then how it's comparable to what it really is, for example, if you compare to the thin static aggregation rate.
So what we are doing is, so you have seen this picture, here time, right? And here we had the position of the electron. Yeah, you're referring to something like this. So and then you have seen that we had this was like one nucleus, this was the other nucleus, and then here something was going on. Yeah, so we are putting not a boundary here, but we are calculating the flux that is going through at some distance out. Yeah, and this you can do time dependently.
This J, you mean?
Yeah. And out of this you can get an ionization rate. And then you're varying this distance to be sure that you see a stable. And we do this, it's not a boundary, but it's just a flux through this.
But the problem is, you put the boundary something like 10 or 5?
Oh no, the boundary where we are absorbing is
far much further. The detector, I mean.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are putting at different distances.
To make sure it's converted.
To make sure, yeah, no. If you would just do it at one distance also, yeah. We would not get
a. Because at that intensity, the quiver motion will be 30, like.
Yes, so we have to understand somehow yeah. what the quiver motion is doing.
Yeah. It should be outside of the quiver motion, for example.
Connected to this, I mean, of course, in tunneling ionization, you assume that most of the electrons have almost no momentum, actually, peaks at zero somehow. And now, I mean, you have to consider also, of course, the time spread it needs to come to your boundary. I mean, there's some very low, slow electrons, which is actually the majority, will need more time than the fast ones. So. It's always something I'm a little bit curious about when these type of calculations are done and often published without any commenting on that, which amazes me, I mean, very much.
Yeah, you should be the referee on our papers. so if we put this figure where we have plotted the ionization rate or the flux through this as a function of time, and we get something like this, whether this peak is exactly here or the curve looks slightly different, we can argue about. Yeah, certainly this. But you see that the flux that is going through this, the line that you have seen, you can make more or less a straight line actually through this. And this is the way that we are calculating. Yeah.
I have a related question.
Yeah.
That is in the discussion of the arrow clock. And just the general principle that you have circularly polarized light and the field is rotating, and so if you measure where the electron comes out, you can determine what time it comes out. But then, as Alejandro pointed out, if you tunnel ionize, the electron has zero momentum and the field is rotating, so that's going to affect the motion. And so how does that determine your interpretation of that clock experiments?
The detailed interpretation of an atom clock experiment, I think it's not simple. Because exactly, you put it, but no, the normal thing that one puts into the interpretation of an atom clock experiment is zero momentum, which is not true, etc., etc. Also, one is usually putting in that there is no effect of the Coulomb field on the electron anymore. Both effects are there, and you have to very carefully take care of this. That's why we show you the snapshot, where we could trace back in our time-dependent simulation where the electron, at which moment the electron is really leaving. And it was not leaving when the field was pointing in this direction, but it was pointing in this direction, yeah? But these effects are there. But the effect that we are seeing there, and that Rainer Dörner has seen in the experiment, and he has interpreted the experiment only because we had the agreement with the theory.
So really the data has to be analyzed in detail to work back to random electron.
Yes, and that was part of my comment that I made yesterday. All these things with the Arthur clock experiment, with this tweaking, et cetera, et cetera. We have to see that we are not jumping to conclusions very quickly. If there is a small rotation in this momentum or something like this, this might be not due that the electron has been ionized at a later time or something like this. But here we could trace it back theoretically. But in experiment, you don't have this chance. So we have really, from the theoretical side, I think we have to provide all this analysis, how experimentalists can analyze all these tools and calculate all these kind of effects that you were talking about and other people were talking about, how they can extract it out to make really a statement about the time of ionization or the time of transition to the continuum or something like this. But that's difficult. Yeah, but there they, I will feel they need our help. That's why we are here.
How do these current-based definitions of the ionization rate compare with just bloody projecting on positive energy ion states as a function of time?
I have not done it, so I cannot.
But it's just a one electron problem.
I mean, yeah, one could do it. Yeah, I cannot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The problem is that you would have to project on the in-field states.
Sure.
Even this doesn't really work properly because you have non-adiabatic effects in the sense that the field is changing, it's not stationary. Mm-hmm. So we tried a lot of these things, mm-hmm. I mean trying to analyze in this respect pattern and forth and back.
But certainly for like the field is constant.
In circular polarized field, if you have no pulse. Yeah.
You have no pulse.
That's the problem.
Yeah, but I mean for a long pulse.
For long pulse, you can do a lot, but then typically, as I said, then you need to take the stationary.
Yeah, I agree with short pulses. Yeah.
But normally, and then the other clock is, of course, a typical example where you want, Jens mentioned it, you want to have a short pulse, then there's a big problem with this.
I think Jens had a question or comment.
Maybe a naive question. I mean, how good can one describe ionization at the long wavelengths, actually, for example? If you just want to know the ionization rate at 4 or 6 microns, I mean, is this no question? I mean, everything's fine? Or, I mean, just as a general question, right? I mean, not related directly to this. Maybe to the last part will we say, oh, we might look into harmonic generation, maybe at longer wavelengths, how this might scale, and if you think about phase matching, you certainly need some ionization rates still.
Okay, I think what is missing there is something on the theoretical as well as on the experimental side. At 800 nanometers, we have such good data that we could actually check all the codes, the different kind of codes that we have over years. And we could really say that we can really make quantitative predictions. I think we are not at this stage for the longer wavelengths. So for this longer wavelengths, Carlos will tell you at some point. He has done time-dependent calculations with the help of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation and with the improvement that the Salamanca group has done with the strong field approximation. And the two of them agree. So, but there is no check with experimental data.
Yeah, but even at 3 microns, there's no ionization data anymore.
I'm not aware of it. I'm aware of some things that you have done, for example, up to something like 2 microns or something like this, and some other people.
I think you has measured something.
Yeah, but I don't see the thing that we have so precise data like we have for 800 nanometer, where Cilian Jin was one who has done this over orders of magnitude, these nice curves, and then you can measure very precisely the intensity, and then you can try to see if you agree with your theoretical calculations to this, at least if you get the, if you get the, follow the curve and where it bends down, so where you have the saturation point, But these kind of measurements, as far as I know, are in this detail not done in at longer wavelengths, and I'm not sure if this is possible or if this is of interest.
So you would agree that there might be a large change in possible conditions for, let's say, harmonics at longer wavelengths depending on these
quantitatively.
It's a field of terahertz radiation, right?
Yeah.
And that field, people assume the field is constant, right? I mean, you could make half a cycle when terahertz.
Sure, but you still want to know the absolute value of the rate, right? And that might still change a bit.
Yeah, but if the static approximation works, then you know it. That's the point. So, I mean, the question will be whether there is some dynamical effects you really have to take into account in this regime, which are not covered by the standard dipole approximation or relativistic Schrodinger equation. But otherwise, of course, what we, as Andrea says, I mean, if you go to longer wavelengths, of course, it gets harder and harder, but it agrees well with what you would expect so far. So there's no surprise on the total ionization. Now, with the looking into very minute details, differential cross-section, photoelectron spectra, etc., there's less, of course, to compare with due to the. Yeah?
So I don't know how far you did this detailed comparison, at least at 800 nanometers.
Yeah. For all these, did you go to longer wavelengths? We also check for longer wavelengths, yeah. And as I said, I mean, we see the convergence, as you were just mentioning, we see the convergence to of the different methods of the strong field approximation through the TDSE with this omega factor missed before. Yeah, but if you take the correct limit, it works. Yeah, but of course, whether there are new surprises at some end, which we have not explored yet, we don't know. But so far, it goes into the same direction. Yeah. So it seems that the simplified models get better and better as you would expect.
So you would feel confident about the absolute rates that you're getting at, let's say, 6 micrometers?
If there is nothing overlooked, what you have not, as I said, in the dipole Schrodinger equation, then yes. I mean, you get convergence at some point with the simplified models, and then you would expect that the simplified models should carry you further. Yeah.
Okay. So, thank you again, Andreas. Yeah.